And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. When Keith Parker was named MARTA's new CEO and general manager, then MARTA board chairman Frederick Daniels Jr. said, quote, "We strongly believe that Keith Parker is the best choice for MARTA. We are extremely proud of the work we have done to this point, and we are very confident that we have picked the right man for the right job at the right time." This was after a unanimous board vote to name Keith Parker the successor to Beverly Scott, no relation. That was in 2012. It was no secret Parker was inheriting a transit agency with some problems. Here's a list: reeling budget deficits, a continuous relationship with the state legislature, and poor perception of the agency. Then, 3 years later, Keith Parker was named Outstanding Public Transportation Manager by the American Public Transportation Association. And with major expansion projects on the way, Keith Parker is stepping down. So what's the current state of MARTA as he leaves, and who will be his successor? Joining me in studio, current, for now, MARTA CEO and General Manager Keith Parker, and MARTA Board Chairman Robbie Ashe. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Howdy.
A little rare that the outgoing CEO and the board chairman are here, but that's a good thing, right?
Well, we wish it was under different circumstances, but we're glad to be here.
Keith, I want to start with you. Why did you want this job back in 2012?
Two reasons. First, my wife and I were expecting our third child, we're from the East Coast, mm-hmm. my wife's family and my family. And so we wanted to get closer to the grandparents and siblings. And then secondly, MARTA at that time was the biggest challenge in all of public transportation. It was generally recognized as the system that had the most issues to deal with, everything from some of the things you mentioned to a very significant financial situation. And so my thought was, if you're going to jump in big and take on the biggest challenge in the industry.
And you were coming from San Antonio, so it was quite a transition, not just in transit systems, but also just in region. You know, Atlanta's a very urban. San Antonio's a little bit urban, but Atlanta's very urban in its regional transportation and who it tries to reach. So at that time in 2012, did you even say, you know what, maybe I'll stick around for 3 to 5 years? I know a lot of CEOs don't like to actually admit that, but did you think, you know, maybe I'll just give it a few years and see what happens?
It was more I'd set some goals for myself and our team. And what I wanted to do was first and foremost get our financial house in order. And we've gone from where the outside auditing firm KPMG projected that MARTA would literally be fiscally insolvent this year, that we would have $0 in our budget reserves. Today we have almost a quarter of a billion dollars. So we were able to do a check mark on that one. Secondly, I wanted to really improve the public perception of the agency. And based upon a lot of the comments you've been seeing or reading over the last few days, I think we've made major headway in that regard. And then third, more than anything else, I wanted people to feel that MARTA was a part of what makes Atlanta special and attractive versus what was holding Atlanta back. And I think we've done that in large measure as well.
I want to play a clip from you, and our senior producer, Candace Wheeler, calls this our way back vault. Take a listen.
Well, I plan to be here for a while longer. My board extended my contract last year. So we're pleased with the way things are going. One of the cool things about what's happening at MARTA right now is that we are one of the more popular transit authorities in the nation right now. So that makes recruiting a lot easier for me when I go out and try to add two members of my team. And I have thoroughly enjoyed the time we've had in Atlanta. We've got a lot more to do.
Now, Chairman Ash, Keith Parker in that clip talked about, you know, there was still a lot more to do. So at this time that he's leaving, is it a good time, a bad time? I don't know if it's ever a great time for a CEO to step down, but how comfortable do you feel with where MARTA is with Keith Parker now leaving?
I'm 100% confident that we are, he leaves MARTA a far healthier and stronger organization than when he joined it. We are, as he said, have $250 million in cash reserves, vastly improved credit rating. I think our operations are in better shape. Our customer satisfaction is certainly better. We've had the first system expansion in 40 years into Clayton County, then a new investment by the city of Atlanta of $250 million I think all of that speaks to the turnaround that he and his team have brought about. You're right. There's a lot still to do. I mean, we don't think of ourselves as a perfect organization at all. We think there's still work inside the house and outside to continue to get to be even better. But the truth of the matter is, in life, when you are successful, that usually brings more challenges and more opportunities. And so there was never going to be a moment at which we sat around and said, okay, Keith, you've done a great job. Now it's time for you to leave. Mm-hmm. And I am incredibly happy for him, for his family, for the opportunity that they have in front of them. I'm really thankful for the time he's spent with us and proud of the work we as MARTA have been able to accomplish. Our task now as a board and as an organization is to go find the person who will help us write the next chapter of excellence in our history.
Did you all try to persuade him from leaving? Did you try to persuade him from leaving?
I've tried to persuade him a number of times.
Do you want to say something now that on air that might work?
No, I've had a couple days to wrestle through the stages of grief. I'm pretty much through that. And as I said, I'm tremendously happy for Keith and for his family. And now we're focused about what does MARTA do next? We went through an exhaustive search last time, 6 years mm-hmm. ago, to find Keith Parker. We engaged a search firm, a national headhunter, did a national search, took us several months, ended up with a couple great candidates, one of whom is sitting to my left today. So that's a process that worked well for us before. It's the process we're going to go through again. I think, given all of the opportunities MARTA has and our bottom line commitment to making sure that we do the best job with the tax dollars we're entrusted with, that's exactly what Atlantans deserve. They're just going to have to bear with us because it's going to take a little bit of time.
Speaking of tax dollars, Keith, perhaps one of the most significant changes to MARTA was the removal of that 50-50 requirement, which basically gave you all a bit more control on how you allocate your funding. Was that key for you as a CEO to get those, as it was called by a lot in the media, the shackles right. taken off of MARTA?
It had tremendous symbolic importance for us because the 50-50 restriction was one of several things that indicated a lack of trust from state government to the transit system. And the fact that we've been able to remove almost all those things really speaks volumes to how much confidence the governor, the lieutenant governor, to speak of the House, the members of the legislature now have in this transit system. So I think that is more important actually than the measure itself, because there have been many other things that they've done to give us more flexibility and more control of the daily authorization of the system.
And Chairman Ash, you will know this too. There was a time when you mentioned the word MARTA down at the state capitol. You got some angry looks, particularly with some, not all, but particularly with some rural lawmakers that didn't want to focus so much on just the Atlanta region when it came to transportation. But what was it like to go through that process of, one, gaining their respect, gaining their belief in what you could do for MARTA and moving forward to where you are now?
Well, it was an interesting process because if you go back and look at the history of it, when the MARTA board announced who the finalists were for the position, I was one of those folks, and a very prominent state legislator mm-hmm. said that if the board hired me, that they would have a very tough time mm-hmm. with the legislature. And Robbie, as well as the rest of the board, held firm, and they selected me. And to that legislator's credit, just a year later, after having made that statement, he said he was wrong and that the MARTA board made the correct choice in selecting me. He was symbolic of the overall turnaround. I remember first meetings with the speaker and the first meetings with the governor and others. All of them were very important. But a big part of that relationship building, too, was the mayor of Atlanta, that he did some of the blocking and tackling for us early on and helped establish some of those relationships. So we're very thankful to the folks at the state level, many of the folks at the local level, and definitely Mayor Reed and some of the work that he helped.
I think one of the things that helped us with that process, and this is something Keith and I share, is a belief that the most important thing MARTA could do, and this was true in 2012, it's still true today, is that MARTA can focus on itself. We can focus on what we can control, and that's making sure that our board remains focused on fiscal discipline, that we have a balanced budget, that we have operations that are on time, that we focus on the safety of our customers and our employees. And it's when we are able to demonstrate that we are responsible stewards of those tax dollars, of the responsibility, and honestly, the public trust, that we then become a candidate for additional investment. I mean, so we didn't go to the state in 2012 or 2013 and say, we need a bailout. We just said, we need the opportunity, we need some breathing room, and we need the opportunity to get our own house in order. And I think the validation of that has been the Clayton County result in 2014, where by a 3-to-1 margin, Clayton County voted to impose a 40-year, 1-cent sales tax mm-hmm. to join the system. Again, in December or in November of 2016, residents of Atlanta, 72% yes vote for an additional half penny to last 40 years. I mean, the conversation around transit in the metropolitan Atlanta region has fundamentally changed, and a lot of that is because of Keith Parker and the changes he's brought to MARTA. I mean, when we were going through the recruitment process before, he and Mayor Reed and I had dinner, and one of the things Kasim said to him was, your first job is to get rid of all the legitimate reasons why people don't want to do business with MARTA. Well, I'm here today, about 6 years later, to say, you know, congratulations on a job well done, and thank you for that. We don't think we're perfect. Again, we think there's still things we can improve, still things we need to work on. But where we are today is dramatically different than where we were. And it's one of the reasons, frankly, that I'm optimistic about our next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
6 years ago, when we went through the search process in candor, I was a little nervous about the quality of the candidates we were going to get for the general manager's job, just because our trajectory was very uncertain. We ended up getting a great slate of candidates, including, again, the gentleman seated to my left. Today, MARTA is, if you'll pardon me, far sexier than it was 6 years ago.
Because of Keith Parker, it's sexy.
And so I expect that we're going to get a wide and deep field of candidates. No one's ever going to be able to replace him. But we're going to have whoever our next general manager is. Our commitment as a board is to make sure that person's great, too.
The voice you hear is MARTA Board Chairman Robbie Ash, and we're also joined by current MARTA CEO and General Manager Keith Parker for now. Let's go back to those early days, because there was a point also where there was talk maybe another entity should operate MARTA. Chairman Ash, can you say, you know, without a doubt that Keith Parker prevented another entity or a state takeover or some other organization operating MARTA, because that was being floated around?
I think that Keith would be the first person to tell you it's not just Keith. It's Keith and the team he brought in and the management approach he brought in. And I do think that the focus on that bottom line, on getting rid of the legitimate reasons why people were skeptical about how we were spending our money, about what our operations looked like, all of those things that he did to really right the ship, those restored our credibility. And I think they have gone a very long way to convincing folks that we know what we're doing and that we are worth the now nearly $1 billion a year in public investment that we represent.
Keith, let's talk about what's still left to do as you depart. When you look at the list of the accomplishments and things you didn't get to, what's on that list of things you just couldn't get to, or, you know, you leave, for lack of better words, hanging?
Well, I view what I do as being a leg in a relay race. So I inherited took the baton from Beverly Scott, who had done admirable work in her 5 years here at MARTA, and she inherited it from Richard McCrillis, who inherited it from Nat Ford, and so on. And so I pay great homage to the people who came before me. So I viewed my job was to take the baton and run as fast and as good of a race as I could in preparing the next person who I'll hand this off to give them a great opportunity for success. So I don't look at it as things that are left undone and so forth, but instead here is the menu of what's going to be there for that next person. So some of those things will certainly include making sure that the city of Atlanta feels as though their investment of $2.5 billion, that Robbie mentioned, was money well spent. And I think we're on a very good trajectory in that regard. The folks in Clayton County with their investment, that they're getting wonderful bus service now, but we intend to expand with a high-capacity transit option through Clayton. And then just so many more things we want to do, technological improvements, the potential for expansion in other areas within our own footprint right now, as well as, I think, attracting some other counties who may have been on the fence, but now watching how transit is attracting Mercedes-Benz and State Farm and Kaiser Permanente and so many others, where just a few years ago, MARTA certainly wasn't the reason mm-hmm. people mentioned as to why they were coming to the Atlanta region.
I think what we're doing a good job of is getting out of our own way. I mean, there are going to be people in the Atlanta region who don't want transit. We mm-hmm. get that. But for the people who are on the fence, for the people who are watching NCR, watching Mercedes, watching State Farm, our job, and I think one Keith has succeeded in admirably, was to make it so that they thought about MARTA, they thought about transit, and they said, oh, yeah, that could work for us. That's something we could look at doing here. Because that's really what the conversation is about in the region now, is a growing recognition that if we want to compete, and not just compete, but if we want to win the economy in the 21st century, transit is going to be an important part of that mix. And that's really what's driving the conversation.
And part of that, when you talk about if you want to be in the winning column, you have to start with your employees, too. We've talked mm-hmm. about MARTA's fiscal health, but let's talk about the employees, because a lot of MARTA employees that have been there for a long time, they can tell you they suffered through years where they did not get a raise. How would you characterize your relationship with MARTA, with the employees, and also being able to compromise on some tough decisions as it relates to raises and also to dealing with, you know, the union folk in that regard?
Well, I met with our employees just yesterday and made the official announcement that I would be leaving. And there was, I guess, a couple of hundred people in our atrium and many others watching, live streaming mm-hmm. from around the agency. And one of the things that was really touching for me was that they gave me two standing ovations, and there were multiple members from the organized labor component there as well. One of the promises I made back in November of 2012, when the board had hired me but I had not yet started, was that if we met certain goals, that we would be giving everybody a 3% bonus or raise come next Christmas. And most MARTA employees had only had one raise in the mm-hmm. previous 10 years. Mm-hmm. Well, they met those projections and we honored that promise. Since that time, we've given our folks a raise almost every year. And we feel good about that and want to do more. And in fact, we've issued yet another challenge that if our first quarter results are solid for this current fiscal year, they'll be getting a raise just before the Christmas holiday. So I think the biggest part of what I feel good about our team is that sense of pride is back, that we had this measure of this anecdotal measure of just seeing how many folks, when they're our own employees, when they're on buses or our own trains or in the mm-hmm. grocery store, that they have their employee badges flipped around where you couldn't see their face. Now there's a much greater sense of pride where people have that badge turned around and folks are proud to say they're MARTA employees.
I'm telling you, it's sexier.
Okay, well, if it's sexier and it's MARTA's at a height of its fiscal health and employees are happy, mm-hmm. why are you leaving?
Well, again, it starts off with family. That my oldest daughter started school at University of Georgia this year.
I can't believe you sent her to an SEC school.
Yeah, total shock to us because we always thought that she would be going to school up north at NYU mm-hmm. or UVA or someplace like that. So she surprised us when she decided that she wanted to stay closer to home mm-hmm. right here in Georgia. The second component was I hit 50 years old. And as a 50-year-old guy, you'd recognize that if you're ever going to do something different, and I've been in this industry now for a couple of decades, mm-hmm. that now would be a good time.
And it's a total different
energy.
Industry.
Oh, yeah. While I have the energy, while I have really good health and passion about what that next step is. So family, along with the opportunity to take on something I care greatly about, namely putting people to work, mm-hmm. that Goodwill's primary mission on this planet is to put more and more people to work, particularly people who are difficult to employ. And that's something I really believe in.
And you have a history with Goodwill from your days in San Antonio as well, correct?
That's correct. I was on their board mm-hmm. almost the entire time, so really got to know the industry. have enormous respect for the person who I'll be replacing, Ray Bishop, who's been a 26-year CEO, very well regarded in the industry. And so this isn't one of those opportunities you could wait for the next time either. So if the next person they hire is around nearly as long as Ray, then obviously I'd be well beyond my employment period.
Chairman Ash, Keith Parker just talked about passion for the job. That's probably one of the characteristics you want in your next CEO and general manager. But let's begin here. When will the interim be named?
Our board meeting is tomorrow.
You want to go ahead and just reveal it right now?
No. We got to vote on it.
Yeah, what's a vote?
I'm a lawyer, so I care about technicalities like that.
And then the process, you're going to hire a national search firm? And
we will. Last time we hired a national headhunter who did the hard work of scouring the transit industry and really even the transportation industry in general for us. We'll do that again because this is, as I said, no one's going to fill Keith Parker's shoes, but we need the next great general manager of MARTA. And finding that person is going to take talent, and it's going to take time. And so that's what we're going to tomorrow we will solicit proposals. We will probably award the contract to the executive search firm sometime in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And then my guess is it'll take between 6 and 9 months to get somebody in place. I obviously hope that it goes a little quicker than that, but I think about what it took last time.
Keith, I'm going to give you the last question. I know CEOs don't like this question, but what is your advice for the incoming CEO?
The two, I think, most important attributes that I bring to this job is, first, I'm a very careful listener. Former U.S. DOT Secretary Anthony Fox gave me one of my best compliments when he said, whenever I'm sitting with Keith, I know he's going to be listening 75% of the time and only talking about 25%. Because he is that type of a thoughtful person. So that's one of the things. The second would be humility. That I just see so many people struggle with trying to cover up mistakes or spending a ton of time trying to not take the blame for things that may have gone wrong or wanting to take credit for things they may have not even been responsible for. And I find that uses up a ton of energy. So I'm a person who's very quick to admit when I've made mistakes, very quick to accept them, and then you can move on. And when you have that type of approach, people are quick to come to you with their mistakes as well because they know that they're not going to be expected to be perfect human beings.
Did you admit mistakes as general manager and CEO?
Oh, many times, many times.
You just didn't put it in a press release.
Oh, I talk about them all the time. So, I interview a lot of people. And when I interview folks, one of my major questions is, tell me a time that you screwed up. And if they struggle with that question and go, well, let me think about that for a while, that if they have to really bang their head on the table to think of a time they made a mistake, it tells me two things. First, they're either in way too easy of a job, or secondly, they're not humble enough to be a part of my team.
MARTA CEO and General Manager Keith Parker, MARTA Chairman Robbie Ash, thank you both for coming in and taking the time. Best of luck to you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for all your appearances on Closer Look. Thank you for the Wi-Fi on the bus.
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks very much.
Support for WABE comes from the University of Georgia in Gwinnett. You can earn your graduate degree while working full-time. More about UGA's programs for working professionals at the Gwinnett Campus Open House on October 21st, gwinnett.uga.edu. And from Reliable Heating and Air, a Trane dealer, a family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. send our host, Rose Scott, an email, rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Andrew Wortham. I live in the Capitol View section of Atlanta. What I like about my neighborhood is that it is accessible to most things. We have a central library. Well, the library is called the Metropolitan Library. And also I like that the neighborhood is improving as far as crime, and it's becoming a more beautiful neighborhood with the sidewalks and the paved streets and all that. And I think people are getting closer because of it.
Double lifetime. I want to start over.
On the next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright. He's written a lot of songs about his life and family. Now he's written a memoir called Liner Notes on parents and children, exes and excess, death and decay, and a few of my other favorite things. He'll bring his guitar and sing some of his songs. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. It will be up to Congress, maybe, to figure out the next step regarding deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA. President Donald Trump has said, quote, "I do not favor punishing children, most of whom are now adults, for the actions of their parents. But we must also recognize that we are a nation of opportunity because we are a nation of laws." Now, the DACA program was created by an executive order under President Barack Obama. In 6 months, the program could possibly phase out a lot of people. We're talking nearly 1 million people nationwide. Here locally, students at Freedom University are among those who are unsure about their future. Now, the Georgia Institution is considered a modern-day freedom school for undocumented students. Emiko Soltis is the executive director of the school. She joins me in studio, along with Freedom University student Alma, a DACA beneficiary. Thank you so much for coming and taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me begin here. President Trump promised to rescind DACA while he was campaigning. But at any point, did you think maybe he wouldn't? And Emiko, I'll start with you.
November 8th was a scary day for a lot of us around the country, and especially among undocumented students and undocumented students here in Georgia. And so I think we knew that it was always a possibility. But over the last 8-9 months, you know, there was growing hope that DACA would remain and that there might even be a possibility of legislation to protect undocumented students and their families. But as this week made clear, that is not the case.
What was yesterday like for you, Inigo?
It was hard. We knew it was coming, but that I don't think took away the pain. Luckily, a lot of us were together, as with some of my students. But, you know, having been together for 7 years, we also know that the most important thing to do is to stay calm and to organize. And so that is where we are focusing our energy right now.
We're going to get to Freedom University in just a second. But Alma, I want to ask you, how long have you been in this country?
I've been here for 23 years.
When did you first arrive?
1995. I was 5 years old.
What was yesterday like for you?
It was heartbreaking in a way, but we stand strong and we have a lot of people behind us, and that made it a lot easier. You know, as Emiko said, we knew that this would happen. It was a temporary protection that was given to us by Barack Obama, and we knew that this day would come. So yesterday was hard, but like I said, we stand strong.
When you hear Attorney General Jeff Sessions talk about some of the concerns with the undocumented who are living in this country in terms of taking jobs, what goes through your mind?
The fact that a lot of what people think is not true. I think that a lot of the there's a lot of misinformation out there, and I definitely want to be able to educate more people on the topics. We're definitely not here taking anyone's job. I have applied for jobs just like anyone else.
Mm-hmm. You are an educator, correct?
Correct. I am an educator. Been one for 4 years now.
Emiko, for those who are not familiar with Freedom University, how did it begin?
Yeah, so unfortunately, Georgia is the most discriminatory and the most hostile state in the country towards undocumented young people.
Why do you say that?
Back in 2010, the Georgia Board of Regents passed two policies, Policy 416, which bans undocumented students, including DACA students, mm-hmm. from the top five public universities, as well as Policy 434, which bans them from in-state tuition. And there's only three states in the entire country, including South Carolina and Alabama. So it's all in the Deep South. These states are the only ones to have admissions ban against undocumented students. And so Freedom University immediately began in the fall of 2011 following the passage and implementation of these policies. And this again was in the context of a lot of anti-immigrant backlash back in 2010 and 2011. In Georgia, we had HB 87, the Show Me Your Papers law. Mm-hmm. That was a copycat bill of Arizona House Bill 1070. So this was a very scary time. It's been a scary time for a long time for immigrants in this country. And so Freedom University is now starting classes this Sunday, actually, September 10th, opening up our seventh year of courses for undocumented students.
Is it an accredited institution?
It is not. We're a modern-day freedom school. There are mm-hmm. no grades, mm-hmm. No credits, but we do provide CLEP courses that allow students to take exams and get credits that can transfer to a future college.
But that does take some funding. How do y'all...
Yeah, so we don't charge students mm-hmm. Any tuition. We actually send drivers to pick them up and bring them to class. And we get funding based on small donations from around the country. And sometimes we even get books donated from 10-year-olds who put their allowance towards a book for an undocumented student so they could continue their education. And so we exist solely based on the donations and small grants of individuals around the country.
How many students are currently, I guess, enrolled?
We have 30 students in our current class.
Alma, let me ask you this. You have talked about your role in society. You're an educator. You have benefited from DACA. What do you think, let me back up, how hopeful are you in the next 6 months on what will happen?
Well, I'm very hopeful just because, you know, you always hope for the best. I definitely don't want to expect the worst, so I'm staying very hopeful. However, I know that under this new presidency, and it's going to be a long road. It's going to be a long road to get to where we want to get, because we no longer want temporary statuses. We want a permanent solution. And I'm not sure if that's going to happen in the next 6 months. I'm not sure if that's going to happen in the next 6 years. But that's what we're going for.
Yesterday on this program, we talked to Charles Cook, who's an immigration attorney. He talked about that now, hopefully, that Congress will do something. Emiko, you all are at Freedom University, but are you all able to reach any lawmakers to hear your plight, to hear your plea? What's that process been like for you all?
Under the 501c3 fiscal sponsorship of the Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights, you know, we aren't able to lobby. But by making sure our students' voices are heard and that we're countering a lot of misinformation in the public, that is how we can push forward comprehensive immigration reform and a permanent solution rather than these small temporary fixes. And I do want to add something to the question of this misinformation that Alma was talking about. Mm-hmm. This idea, this rhetoric that people are taking jobs, taking seats away. This really underscores the criminality that's implied in this, which is how modern racism takes root in this country. It is not based on overt racial terms, but on criminalizing people of color and then discriminating based on that criminal status. And I think it's important to reverse that question. What are we taking away from undocumented people? What are we taking away from them? And those statistics are very important. In the last decade, undocumented immigrants have contributed more than $100 billion into the Social Security Fund and will likely never receive any of those benefits. Undocumented immigrants also pay taxes. Mm-hmm. In Georgia alone, undocumented immigrants pay more than $350 million every single year into state and local taxes. They pay taxes, but they cannot vote. This is simply taxation without representation. So I wonder where the Tea Party activists are now when we need them.
And DACA beneficiaries are eligible for work permits. Alma, have you had any challenges? You're working now, but in the process when you were looking for employment, was this an issue from any of your potential employers that you were undocumented?
No, not since I have the work permit. It has not been an issue. It is questioned by my employers sometimes where they do ask, well, what kind of permit is this? Why is it only for 2 years? Or what's going to happen after the 2 years end? So sometimes I have to explain, you know, okay, after the 2 years I have to renew and so on and so forth. But now that's not the case, of course.
Have you spoken to your current employer since all this happened yesterday? I know it's only been really less than 24 hours, but
I have not. I have not spoken to my employer as of yet.
What do you think that conversation is going to be like?
I don't foresee any issues as long as my permit is valid still, of course.
Your permit is valid until?
Until April 2018, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And after that, I'm sure we can sit down and have a conversation. I know that I won't be able to have the same job. I work for a county school, and mm-hmm. there's just no way that working for a county school without a permit is possible. At least not a way that I know. So I know that's going to change, but I will walk across the bridge when I get there.
Where originally are you from and your family?
I'm from Mexico, Jalisco.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a lot of family members here as well who are undocumented?
I do. My immediate family is all here. We're all under the same. The only one who is a citizen is my younger brother.
What's the conversation been like with all this going on?
Well, it's definitely been upsetting for my parents, especially because they are afraid for their daughters. Mm-hmm. They're definitely afraid for their daughters, more so than for themselves. And, you know, talking about permanent solutions, I want to make sure that this permanent solution also includes them and that we are not making them seem like the villains in the mm-hmm. story, because yes, although they made the decision as adults to bring us here, they are not the villains. They mm-hmm. came here for a reason, and I think it's hard. It's easy for us to forget the human side of that story. So when I say that we want a permanent solution, I want to include not just students, mm-hmm. not just those childhood arrivals like myself. I want to include our parents and those original dreamers that came here.
Emiko, as we get back to Freedom University and the courses that you all are providing and the resources, tell me about those.
Yeah, so we meet on Sundays. Most of our students work 40, 50 hours a week. And so Sundays is the only day they can consistently come to school. And so we have classes from 2 to 6 p.m. This semester we have classes in biology, in Spanish literature, a human rights course that I teach, as well as a college preparation course that identifies welcoming colleges across the country and helps them with the college application process.
Are the educators who are teaching, are they doing this as volunteers?
Yes, they're volunteer professors. Freedom U runs based on the love and labor of many, many people, from volunteer drivers to students at universities who help them with their college applications, to the professors from Spelman, from Morehouse, from Emory, from Georgia Tech, from Georgia State, who are volunteering their time and expertise to make sure that undocumented students receive an education.
What's the future for Freedom University if DACA has been rescinded?
Freedom U existed before DACA existed. Mm-hmm. Freedom U will continue to exist as long as undocumented students are banned from college and do not receive equal access to higher education. We'll stand by them every step of the way.
Do you think that Congress can come up with what's considered a legal pathway for citizenship as it relates for Dreamers? Do you feel optimistic about that?
I believe that the power lies in grassroots mobilization, how much citizens who call undocumented people our friends, our family, our students, our teachers, how we are able to mobilize effectively to get our Congress people to pass comprehensive immigration reform that is, again, not just for young people, but also for their parents.
Emiko Soltis, who is the executive director of Freedom University, and also Alma, who is a beneficiary of the DACA program. Thank you both for coming in and taking the time. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from the Bremen Museum, presenting Bearing Witness, Remarkable Stories from the Holocaust, featuring Hank Lewin telling the story of his parents, Nora and Joel. Admission is complimentary, Sunday, September 10th at 2 p.m. More at thebremen.org.
This week on All Things Considered, for some, the path to an opioid addiction starts in a dentist's chair.
Well, you know, we're in the pain business. People come to see us when they're in pain, or after we've treated them, they leave in pain.
A look at what dentists are doing to fight prescription opioid abuse, plus the latest from Capitol Hill on Harvey funding, healthcare, and immigration. Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
From 4 to 6:30 on 90.1 WABE.
Community issues are what drives the conversations here on Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Tell me what's happening where you live. Send an email to rose@wabe.org. Again, that's rose@wabe.org. This is member supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
Well, my name is Jimmy, and I was born and raised in the West End here. Well, I like the community because we still get together and have fun, you know, whenever, you know, it don't matter what day it is.
I see the crystal raindrops fall and the beauty.
Well, it has changed a whole lot, really. I remember when houses used to be here. Few things still could be changed. I would change the corner store by the school because it's been that building a bit older than me.
If we try, just the two of us, building castles in the sky, just the two of us, you and I.
If you want to understand this world, just follow the money.
Chicken is a big business. We are a chicken nation.
In terms of a whitewater year, this is going to rank in the top five.
The running joke in Hollywood is that no movies ever make money.
Oil, of course, is the lifeblood of modern civilization.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Stories from all over the economy. Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.1 WABE.
And you're tuned to Closer Look here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. When this program began in 2015, one of the first places producer Candace Wheeler and I agreed we needed to do a story on was the Peachtree Pine Homeless Shelter. Inside, we met Anthony. He was in charge of the rooftop garden.
It's going to help you out a lot, you know, calm down a lot and everything. And it's basically helping me get my life back together. And everything, you know, I got my GED, my high school diploma, and when I turned around and went and got my get certified through agriculture and everything, that could do nothing but a smile on my face. It was basically helping me get my life back together. And everything, you know, I got my GED, my high school diploma, and when I turned around and went and got my get certified through agriculture and everything, that could do nothing but a smile on my face. And I just love doing it.
The doors to the largest shelter in the city are officially closing now. The Metro Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless had operated the building that sits on the corners of Peachtree and Pine Streets for a number of years. But also, the shelter had been at the center of controversy and legal negotiations. There were concerns about safety. There was concerns about criminal activity. Well, finally, the task force agreed to vacate the building, allowing Central Atlanta Progress to take over the property. Carl Hartrump is the executive director of the Metro Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless, and he's been volunteering with the shelter since the 80s. He joins me now in studio. Carl, welcome.
Thank you, Rose. Appreciate being here.
When you hear Anthony's story that we play coming into the segment, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, it brings back a lot of memories. I really enjoyed working with Anthony, and the roof garden has been a real gem of the Peachtree Pine Task Force location. And we're going to continue that at our new location. But just listening to the men that have been there, and particularly that clip, think about all the great memories we had and all the good work we did.
So physically, the place will not be the same, but you are transitioning in terms of to another facility?
Yes, we're leaving the building. We've already officially left the building. Mm-hmm. The men are still there, and we're transitioning some of the men in our RV program, resident volunteer program, and the transition program to another facility, and we're moving our administrative offices to the west side. And we have plans to put two new gardens, urban farms, in place and train the men that want to participate in that with Rashid Nuri at the Truly Living Well farm to in that same program that Anthony mentioned. We have currently one young man that's with us now that has a full-time job at Truly Living Well that went through that program. So we have a lot of good ideas and new ideas. It's just sad to be leaving our home at Petrie and Pine.
Carl, you say it's sad to be leaving. When you look back, was there anything that you all as the entity operating this shelter that you all could have done differently, that maybe the outcome wouldn't have gotten to where it is now?
No, I think if you look at it in the overall sense of the development and growth of Atlanta, we not only have a growing homeless problem, which all urban communities have, and that's in dispute, but we also have a growing urban environment, redevelopment environment, and so basically we were gentrified out of our place. The hospitals around us, the apartment complexes, the condominiums around us, they just didn't want us to be there.
We've all driven down past that building. You see the numerous amounts of people outside of there. There were issues about crime, criminal activity. Can you understand that?
Oh, well, there's always reasons and issues that people that move into a community want to change. Mm-hmm. And so we're not even debating that. We understand that issue. We ask for help from the police department to clean that up, and because those men and women that were hanging on the streets were not part of our clientele. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was some debate about that, but I can understand the image, and we frankly feel that was used against us to put more pressure on us to leave.
On a given night, how many people stayed at the shelter?
Well, it fluctuates. Mm-hmm. On a warm night in the summer, we may have 250, 300 men and women and children. On a cold night in the winter, we would have up to 1,000 people in the building.
Producer Candace Wheeler and I, we spent hours and hours inside Peachtree Pine Shelter. It was in desperate need of repair. I know a lot of folks volunteered to come help y'all out. There was a outbreak of TB, as you know, as well. Did you just not have enough funding to also keep the building, the facility up as well? And did funding dwindle over the years because of all the other issues and the perception?
Yes, we had a master plan to redevelop the building, make it sustainable, green, water. We're going to harvest on rainwater. So we had it fully budgeted and fully estimated by a contractor. We were at the same time receiving great pressure to move, and our funding was reduced over the years. And so we basically ended up losing all of our federal and state money and relied only on those truly dedicated private individuals that wanted to continue to give us money, mainly to just exist. All we could do is pay our utilities and pay some of the supplies and minor repairs.
Why was your funding reduced on the federal and local level?
Well, again, it was that the city wanted us to move, and so the city exerted great pressure on us through their grants department to cut our city, state, and federal funding. And that was part of the discussion and the legal battles that we had with the city and other people was about how that funding was cut off and how we needed it to survive.
Moving forward to the new location, I imagine there are some lessons learned from all the years at Peachtree Pine that you all can look at and use as a template for not to do moving forward. If so, what are they?
Well, first, we're not going to open an emergency overflow shelter. We have actually negotiated in our settlement agreement that the United Way and the City of Atlanta will work together to open additional shelters. And so we're going to be monitoring that and making sure that happens, and we'll at the same time be delivering services to our same client base and the client new clients that come to us from those shelters or from the street. So we're going to continue our role as advocates, mm-hmm. and we're going to create some job training programs, but we're not going to be operating an emergency shelter right off the bat.
But will you still have some residential intake you'll be able to do that process that you used to do at Peachtree Pond?
Yes, we will continue to receive clients and refer them to housing, and also we will maintain our transitional and volunteer program.
When we think of settlement, we think of dollars. Were you all able to receive a satisfactory amount to help you with this transition?
Again, that's confidential, sure. The amount is, but we did after we paid all our debts, we did receive enough funding to continue our mission.
And what about being good stewards of the neighborhood for your new location?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's one thing we're very concerned about, working with the neighborhood, and we are right now negotiating with a landlord on the west side to begin our operations there, close to the Jefferson Place shelter that's going to open, so mm-hmm. we'll have access to our client base and the Good Samaritan Clinic, where a lot of our clients go. And we'll also be working with neighbors in the area on our jobs program and our urban farming program.
We've asked this question so many times in terms of affordable housing. I'm going to ask you about Atlanta's homeless crisis. Is it at a crisis? Is it at an epidemic?
We believe it's a crisis, and we think the four main causes. One is the lack of affordable housing. I mean, that's just the problem that's existed for years, and it's getting worse. I mean, you can't an individual that makes a minimum wage cannot afford a one-bedroom apartment.
You mentioned there are people who have full-time jobs.
Oh, yes.
They rely on the shelter.
That are in the shelter with full-time jobs because they can't ever save enough to make a deposit or utility payment. The second thing that we realize is, again, the lack of affordable wages. In other words, you can't maintain a household on a minimum wage. You have to have even two people on minimum wage can't maintain a household, pay child care, pay for all the services. So the lack of living wage jobs is another issue. And the third is that we have a system in place, and the DACA guest before mm-hmm. mentioned that, it's a criminalization of poverty and race. And so we have built-in institutional discrimination that creates obstacles for people to maintain their homes or achieve their own independent living. And then finally, of course, is the medical and health care issues. Though that is some of the one, it keeps people in homelessness, but also it forces people into homelessness.
And Carl, as we wrap up, because I want to touch on what you just said, that fourth factor, which is medical, and particularly with mental health mm-hmm. Conditions, how are you all prepared to address that? Do you have partners that you can refer people to when they come in? Because you can't serve everybody. They may have conditions or needs that you all just can't meet.
Right. We have a direct relationship and partnership with the Good Samaritan Clinic. We also have a very good relationship with the Fulton County Department of Health. And so we make referrals constantly to other health providers. And we have on staff a full-time drug counselor that makes referrals to rehab.
You've been involved with this shelter, with the mission for a long time. Why do you do this?
Well, it goes back to my background in housing and development. When I was just out of law school, I was actually renovating houses in Virginia Highlands. And I realized that as I renovated those houses in Virginia Highlands, I was decreasing the supply of affordable housing. And so I knew I had to put something back in the system because I was making money, you know, improving the system, but I was depleting the system on the bottom. So to me, it's a cycle. It's an engine that needs to be developed, and we're way behind. I mean, we've been working this for a long time, and we haven't solved it yet.
Carl Hartrump, Executive Director of the Metro Atlanta Task for the Homeless. We've been talking about the closing of the Peachtree Pine shelter at that location, but also transitioning to a new location. Carl, thanks for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time, too.
That's it for today's show. Closer Look was produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Fox, and our engineer is Elizabeth Eads, our executive producer, Christine Dempsey. A special thanks to the entire WABE News team, as well as our digital services crew, because they keep us on the web, where you can go to wabe.org/closerlook, and you can listen to Closer Look also weeknights at 9 p.m. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.